Balcony's first ever year-round bourbon was an inspiration. It all had to work together. A blend of carefully selected ingredients, Texas-sized pot stills, and creative people determined to find the absolute best way to usher a new whiskey along. When you discover how it pairs with a meaningful moment, suddenly the feeling of drinking great whiskey becomes a whole lot more.
Hey everybody, welcome to this week's episode of Whiskey Neat, spirited conversations with interesting people. I am your host, Christopher Hart. Now, for those who have watched the show before, I love a good, great, deep conversation. The tagline of the show, spirited conversations with interesting people. I don't know if I've said that in a while. Today I sit down with a very interesting person. John Polono is a, well, now he's an actor, or he's been an actor, but a writer, a director. He's done a little bit of everything, but he wrote a play in 2011 that was extremely successful theatrically, called Small Engine Repair. And it's now a film. It's debuting September 10th. Today's the first. Well, for you guys, it'll be the third. So in about a week, next week, and next Friday, starring John Bernthal, Shea Whigham, John Polono, that basically tells a story about three friends who haven't seen each other in years. They've grown up together. They need to meet at this auto body shop one night for some unknown reasons, and some shenanigans ensues. If you've got any children whatsoever, I encourage you to watch this film, just not with them. Unless they're teenage daughters, make them watch it. But the film is incredible. I was so unbelievably blown away by it. I am taking my family next weekend to watch it, even though I've already seen it. I had to talk to John. So John joins me today. I sent him a care package of some bottles of whiskey. We talk about his accomplishments. He's working on this, obviously. And of course, for those who know, there's a new Hulk Hogan movie coming out. John is a big part of that film. So we talk a little bit about the Hulk Hogan film. We talk everything we can about this film that John's working on, or that airs next week. It was just, this episode was everything. So, I had a great time talking to him. He's incredibly nice. So let's pay the bills. Let's get to our sponsors. Whiskey Neat is brought to you in part by Legent Bourbon. Legent is a super premium bourbon that melds Kentucky distilling tradition with Japanese blending excellence. Legent is a perfectly balanced yet complex and layered whiskey with a bright, unexpectedly long finish, and you can order a bottle of Legent today via drizzly.com, and as always, please be responsible. This week's episode is also brought to you by our friends over at Sagamore Spirit Rye Whiskey. They are reviving the tradition of Maryland-style rye whiskey at their Baltimore farm and waterfront distillery. Each batch of their whiskey is hand-blended for consistency in aroma, flavor, and texture, creating a balanced flavor profile with notes of warm cinnamon, vanilla bean, honey, and spice. But look, I've talked about them every week. I'm a fan of Sagamore. We've done several single barrel selections, and in fact, we may have one coming for this show soon. That's in a special cask strength finish. So I'm really excited to talk to you about that. You can find Sagamore almost anywhere you can find a good whiskey selection. They are there. They're on the shelf. They're fantastic. Go order some. And lastly, our folks, one of the best imported whiskey portfolios in the country is with GlassRev Imports. GlassRev.com, Amroot, Waterford, Blackadder, Murray McDavid, Bimber, and so many other top-rated unique whiskeys. My friends over at GlassRev, Raj, Jane, and Bill, are the original three dram hunters and are inviting you to be a fellow dram hunter. A group of folks passionate about finding great drams. Right now, you can go to GlassRev.com, click on the top bar, mention you heard about this show from Chris at Whiskey Neat, and they will set aside a Murray McDavid rare tasting for those who mention our show. Go to GlassRev.com, that's GlassRev.com, and become a dram hunter today. Without further ado, please welcome John Polono. Cheers. John, thanks so much for doing this.
Hey man, my pleasure.
I'm so excited for a multitude of reasons. One, any chance to have a few glasses of whiskey at 3 p.m. on a Wednesday is it's a good excuse. But two, I watched the film, and as someone, so I didn't know, you know, I don't follow Broadway. I love movies. I consider myself a cinemaphile. I had not heard of the film, and I was just absolutely, as someone who has daughters, I've got 15 and 16 year old daughters. I watched an interview did where we kind of touched on the idea of toxic masculinity. I was blown away. I was captivated. I can't wait till it comes out. I'm forcing both of them to watch it. Yeah. Yeah. So first off, I mean, do you drink whiskey? Are you a big whiskey fan?
I do. I love whiskey. You know, I like whiskey, scotch, and bourbon, depending upon the different mood. I think I'm primarily like a whiskey guy, you know. I love like a Jameson neat, and like a nice a pint is like perfect for the right mood. But I'm all about the brown liquid.
One of my the idea for this show originally was, you know, I've seen a bunch of interviews that seems to be a bit, you know, you doing press junkets and interviews can be a bit formal, a bit monotonous, and I've noticed that the one thing that breaks the ice in most interviews or most meeting anybody is to get a few drinks in them. So
no, you're right about that.
And this is why we give you full control over the interview in case there's something we need to cut out. we had a great interview with Dolph Lundgren once. And I swear to God, I thought his publicist was going to ask us to cut some things out. And he was like, nah, it's fine. Leave it in. So
yeah, I mean, if you're Dolph Lundgren, I think that you can pretty much say and do whatever you want.
You can do whatever you want. I mean, we mentioned this a little before the show started. If you're John Bernthal, I would imagine you can do the same thing too. I'm such a obvious, everyone's been a fan of his for quite some time, but you guys have worked together quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And doing a little research about Small Engine Repair, I learned that it was a play first and that John was actually in that as well.
Yeah.
You guys have been working together on this project again and again and again, and now it's going to be on the big screen.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was really a handful of times in your life you kind of meet somebody and you kind of click like that. It's almost as hard as finding, you know, finding a collaborator like that. It's like finding a true love, you know. And we clicked really quick. And I think he was in the second reading we ever had of the material at a friend's house. And I had seen Walking Dead and I recognized him, and I like loved him in Walking Dead. I was like, oh my God, this guy's great. And I think what I was initially attracted about him as a performer ended up being totally real. The guy doesn't lie on camera. He's who he is. And he is able to put facets of himself so brilliantly, but like, he's just a great dude, and he is an artist, but he's just a really good guy. I mean, look, I could talk forever about him. I love him and I appreciate him so much. And, you know, I've worked on enough stuff that you walk around with like a celebrity or a big actor, and somebody will come up and be like, hey, can I have a picture? And can I do that? They'll be like, yeah, sure, whatever. But John, like, I mean, he loves it. I mean, I've been at bars in the East Village and people come up to him. They're like, are you John Bernthal? And he'll be like, no, that's not me. Yeah, it is. Come on over here. Let's get a picture. And he's just so effortlessly himself and so eager to share. So that's how he was when I first met him. I mean, he was sort of on the cusp of much bigger things. We did this reading of the play and he loved it. And like, you know, we did this small late night production, low budget. My wife was producing these late night plays at our theater. So it's like you have the main stage play and then you peel all the props and everything off and you throw your shit out there really quick while everybody's leaving, and it's filled with people drinking whiskey and beer. It's like no holds barred. You can practically smoke in the theater and you do this late night thing. I'm like, I don't know if this guy's going to want to do it, but he's like, I love this. I want to do it. Coincidentally, and this is just sort of how kismet sometimes is he was like, he's having a legal issue with the cops that he couldn't leave LA. You know, he got into some trouble. This is before his kids were born. You know, I've known him for a long time. It was sort of the tail end of sort of his rougher years. And he was like, I'm kind of like, can't leave LA, so I can't take any other job. So this thing presented itself where like, you're stuck in the city, you might as well do it. So we started and yeah, I mean, really early on, like, you know, it's funny. The dude showed up first day of rehearsal on this little play and he knew every line. He knew everyone else's lines. Like he was overprepared. It's like he was worried he wouldn't get the job. You know what I mean? And yeah, from that day on, we just kind of clicked and we were always like, hey, you know, we've worked on so many other things since then, but this was sort of the beginning of that relationship. And always we felt like we had lightning in a bottle with the material, and it was so battle tested that we're like, yeah, we should definitely have to make this into a movie someday. It's primarily contained in one area. It seemed to have all the facets of like a lower budget movie that we could kind of control. You know, it's not like a $20 million movie where you have so many people eyeballs on it. You can't really have that sort of unfiltered vision. So,
well, yeah. It's, I don't know if there's, is there a director that you would like to be compared to? And I ask that because my first initial thought, and I hope it's taken as a compliment, is this film caught me off guard. I'm trying to get a feel for who these characters are. I'm watching a couple of old rapscallion friends being, you know, roughhousing and making bad. And I know plenty of people like that. You know, they weren't from the New England area, but they, you know, they were good people that just constantly got themselves in trouble. And I'm trying to get a feel for this movie. Then all of a sudden you realize it starts building under the surface. You realize what's really happening and why this is, why we're all here. It reminded me of, I don't know if Tarantino's the right comparison, but that movie, what was that movie? The Hateful Eight.
Right.
Where it all takes place in like one principal area for the vast majority of the film. And you're trying to understand what's, you know, why are we all here? What's going on? And then when it finally clicks, you're like, this is goddamn genius. Like I try not to blow so much smoke up your butt, but I thought the film was absolutely brilliant, man. I thought it was great.
Thanks, dude. I really appreciate that. Now look, I love a Tarantino reference. I mean, I love that dude. I mean, I just read his Once Upon a Time in Hollywood novelization. That's how much I love him. I mean, I think I, you know, it was such a seminal experience for me. You know, I think I was, let's see, 94. Yeah, I was still in college and I saw Pulp Fiction, and the experience of being in the audience for Pulp Fiction. And this is before I'd ever seen a play. I didn't have any involvement in theater at that time, but I saw the way that he sort of held the audience in the grip of that movie, that you're like laughing and you're leaning forward and you love the characters and you're terrified. And it was just that visceral cinematic experience that was so impactful that I've always sort of looked for in a lot of my work. And I mean, I love all his movies you know, I think Hateful Eight is a good comparison. Hateful Eight feels kind of like a theatrical, almost like a play, and Small Engine Repair's roots are in theater. So it's a similar thing where it's like, here, you're parked in this situation. Now we open it up and things change, but it's still the tension of that room is ratcheting it up. And that, you know, theater has a history of those kind of, you know, pressure cooker type stories.
Well, and now that we mentioned Tarantino, it reminds me, you know, you've got Reservoir Dogs has a nice principal area where the vast majority of the film comes to a culmination of intensity. Mm-hmm. And there's a few examples of that. And so I just feel like it's the perfect recipe. And the story is just so good. I got to imagine, you said it was always meant to be a movie the entire time.
No, I mean, at first it was a play. You know, I had came out to L.A. to write screenplays, and that didn't really work because I was just writing movies about movies. It was super derivative. And then I started to take acting classes and started a theater company and just started devouring plays and took a deep dive in theater. I kind of said, I'm going to stop writing movies. I want to write plays. I love the theater so much. And devouring all these authors and playwrights and seeing plays, I was like, holy shit. This is like just opening my eyes. And then I did that for a long time. And this wasn't really, I didn't write it thinking it would be a movie. I mean, I've written a lot of plays. This one was just, you know, the movie is a very simple character-driven story that leans towards a thriller in a very high stakes end. And that's very cinematic, the stakes. You know, I think a lot of plays have trouble translating because the stakes are so nebulous. They don't always translate. Whereas Small Engine Repair, it's like we could just even make it more intense and just continue to amplify that. And that was hugely cinematic.
Yeah, I think one of the characters on top of John Bernthal being in it and definitely playing himself, like this visceral, almost, I don't want to say caveman-like, but there is this primalness to him, a savagery to him that's so intense to watch. I mean, anyone who watched The Punisher could attest to that. But I loved Shay. I thought everything about the character of Packy was both funny and interesting and fascinating. I mean, I've been following him for years, and I thought that he was so perfect for the part.
No, I mean, I've known John for years. He's part of the evolution of the story, and I was writing it for him, and I know his voice. I know how to do that. And Shay was a good friend of John's, and I met him through this process, but we became close. He's a dear friend now. And I mean, he brought color and depth to this character. And I'd been involved in various iterations of the play with brilliant actors. Shay just sort of plucked it and made it his own, and found a much more colored, complicated, tragic version of that character with like just an endless well of empathy and all that. And to me, you know, I love his performance so much. And we were able to sort of create a lot more subtle thematic echoes through his character in terms of his sexuality and his displacement and all that. You know, this is a guy that if he didn't grow up in this environment and had more opportunity, he could have really been a remarkable captain of industry. And he sort of suffocated by all of this. Oh, so I really loved that. And I thought he brought that in every step of the way. I mean, you know, again, to speak on Bernthal's, obviously he knew that character, he lived in it and made it really work. And John has the charisma to pull that off and call himself out on his own bullshit. And Shay was just like, you know, just found this guy, you know, he would just show up at it, and he lost a bunch of weight, and he was just so deep into it. I was, you know, in love with what he did, and it informed everything, you know. And he and John know each other, and like John would just bust each other's balls incessantly in front of him behind the camera. And it just like, you can't act that to some extent. That chemistry is very, very difficult to replicate. And they, you know, it was just there.
There's something, and you hit the nail on the head. I knew so many people growing up. There was this guy that used to hang out with our group of friends. He was a little shorter than everybody. And I look back on that time, and we're still friends now, but I look back on that time and realize that we were savagely mean to this poor person, and we called him a friend.
Right.
And in any other situation, like with Packy, he might have been a very successful person, but he's surrounded by Neanderthals. He's right. Incredibly intelligent. He's incredibly, everything about him seems like a smart, normal guy, but in an area that isn't meant for that personality to flourish. And there was so much.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, he, you know, that you hit the nail on the head for sort of in what he did in his creation of him, and sort of, you know, Packy sort of embodies the concept of the beta male. And how you have this group, and he's the beta, and the beta, you know, in the wolf pack keeps the guys together just as much as the alpha. So he's okay to be the punching bag, to do this stuff. And he brings them closer. It's like when things get really intense with Frank and Sueno, it's like, okay, let's turn to this. And it releases tension. It's just the function of that. And it was like sort of, you know, obviously the movie takes a deep dive on those sort of dynamics for better and for worse. But I've always been fascinated with that sort of concept of the beta in a group being, you know, just as important as anything else.
Well, and there's, depending on where you are in the country, a beta can be the alpha, not physically. That person's not going to be the football QB, but in, especially when they grow up and they go to college and they start careers and they own businesses, oftentimes it's not the alpha it's the beta hiring the alpha to work for them. Right. Like it's the beta 100%. Version.
Yeah.
So it's so fascinating where you've got someone who was just born in the wrong time period in the wrong part of the country, who never quite got to be himself. And even there's even that breaking point when they haven't seen each other in a while where he's like, God damn it, I'm so sick of this. Like he just, it's so good. I sent you a package. Let's pivot. I sent you some things.
Yes.
I definitely want to dive a little bit deeper into literally every character. I thought they were goddamn genius. But what all did I send you? I know for sure I sent you a bottle of Balcones. I sent you a bottle of Sagamore.
Yeah.
So Sagamore is a Maryland rye. So it's there are distilleries in Maryland. I thought that would be a nice little beginning, you know, from that area up there. Yeah, we could start with the rye and go from there.
All right. I just want to say, as like a side note, when I was a kid, really young, I heard a barking one night when I was about 5 years old, and I went downstairs, and in the kitchen there was a box, and in that box was a puppy that my parents had gotten. And I pulled it out, and as the story goes, my parents used to say, I ran up and I was like, look what the mailman gave me. It's like, and that was always a family story that they'd pull out. And then when I opened the box of this whiskey, I realized this is the second best box I've ever had in my life. And I would almost equate the two, sort of the joy of opening this has brought me back to that moment.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. One of the favorite aspects of this is we get our hands on some really interesting things. Of course, there's stuff you can find and, you know, Sotheby's and some auction houses and that sort of thing. But sometimes you get really, really old things. So one of the bottles I sent you, I know we'll start with the Sagamore.
It's excellent.
It's a nice rye. They do a blend of a couple different things, and we're huge fans of them. So jumping back into the film, I watched the interview you did on another podcast that aired about a week ago. But this answer to this question didn't happen. How did we go from a very, very successful play, theatrical performance back, you know, almost 10 years ago now, to, okay, let's make this into a movie. Let's use the same cast pretty much.
Well, you know, when I first started out, Small Engine Repair, the play, was my writing sample. And it was when I signed with new agents, it was at a time where it was kind of unique to share a piece of theater, a play, as your sort of writing sample, as opposed to, you know, screenplays. And that was sort of my thing. And there was some heat, a lot of different places wanted to option it, to turn it into a movie. And I don't know, something about it, I always kept out of that. And I was always like, I want to do this. And so it just kind of took a little while for John and I to get to a point where we could do it, you know, where certainly his name would help pull a team together and help with the finances. I had made enough movies at that point, had enough scripts. You know, I had worked on enough cool things. You know, one of the producers on Stronger, Scott Silver, ended up, he and I have become writing partners on a lot of stuff. And, you know, the guy's a genius, and I just learned so much. And that was kind of like the stars aligned. And I was like, I'm ready to adapt this for myself, as opposed to letting someone else run with it. And, you know, I had various producers over the years say, hey, I'd love to take that play, and that's the first act. And then it's guys on the run with a body in the thing, more of like a Hangover type movie. And I was always like, no, let's keep it in-house. I remember early in my career, when I first moved to LA, I worked at Castle Rock Entertainment in the mailroom. And I got to know Chris Guest pretty well, who was like a very tough nut to crack. But once you got to know him, he's like a really smart, interesting dude. And one thing I just heard him say was, he said that he keeps the budgets of his film at a certain level so that he can do what he wants. And I kind of was like, well, that's a really smart thing. So how can we keep it doable? You know, and that just sort of things aligned with, you know, everyone's schedules, and it just started to put together. And then, you know, and there we were, the shooting was blessed, everything worked. And then other than COVID, which is, you know, what are you going to do? You know, the stars aligned. We couldn't have been happier with how it came out. And, you know, it was also, I got to say, thematically, you know, when I wrote it in 2011, the heart of it was the same. And it was sort of about the infancy of a certain kind of technology. You know, it was at the first draft of the play was Foursquare, which is something that I was like, oh my God, what is this? Where's this headed? And then as social media has certainly crept deeper and deeper, and then Instagram and all this stuff, and the stories that echo the story of Crystal became more and more prevalent. And then Me Too movement happened, where a lot of these stories were being, people were kind of, you know, and sometimes forced to listen, but the ideas of this were more and more part of the national like discourse, that it was just like, okay, the time is right. So it just kind of clicked artistically, timing wise and everything. You know, you're like pushing a boulder up the hill, and then suddenly it starts rolling down, and you're like, all right, here we go.
Well, I think, I really do think, and I know that it's going to seem like an overnight success. Obviously, you've been at this for a long time. But the way that this has played out, it seems to be working to make sure that you have your best foot forward. I mean, you've had to practice on it in terms of making it a very, very successful theater play. Mm-hmm. And so you've had this long-term, and you guys, I mean, I'm sure there was a lot of the same lines even, I'm sure, made their way over.
Right.
So you guys have had practiced and practiced and practiced. And then when you finally get the chance, and this is your directorial debut as well, correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah. So imagine a scenario in which you get your big Hollywood directorial debut and it's a film you're not really familiar with. I mean, you know everything about this idea, the concept, the execution, and you're doing it with people that you're friends with. Like your best foot, both feet are forward in the best possible way. And it's exciting. And as I said, I've got 15 and 16 year old daughters and we have three rules in our house. Do you have kids?
I have a 16 year old daughter and a 6 year old son.
Yeah. So I've got four total, but the two teenagers, we realized early, like if they're going to cuss, they're going to cuss. If they're going to,
I have zero problem with that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we have three rules in the house. Don't do it in front of us. Don't do it in front of other parents and never, ever, ever do it on camera. And those rules apply to everything at this age.
That's actually good advice. I mean, look, I think that's sort of what the movie, you know, explores is this idea of like, certainly when we came up, we made mistakes. People didn't have a video camera, like a 4K video camera in their hand.
Right.
So, you know, that's sort of part of it and sort of the generational change that obviously these working class guys don't quite understand as things are changing. And what is that? I mean, I think the sort of paradigm of the movie, of this story, would have looked much different 20 years ago. You know, you still could have had those Hitchcockian elements, the character elements, all of that stuff, but it would have been something different. And that was, again, to your point, that this is the moment to sort of have these stories and we're all learning and certainly our teenage kids understand it way better than we do, but their mistakes are amplified. and you know, once it's out there, it's out there. And you know, it's the same shit we dealt with, but now it's like the stakes are higher and it can spread like that. And that's, I mean, as a parent, that's terrifying.
Yeah. It's far more, everything is like, I think you said amplified. I think that was the word you said. Everything is far more amplified now than it's ever been. I mean, back when I was in high school, you know, your worst nightmare was not being someone's top eight on their MySpace page. Like it wasn't really a thing. And now, you know, the prevalence of these sorts of things and the damage that comes from them is just so much more severe than it ever has been. So, God, it's fantastic. All right.
That was good stuff.
All right. So what else did I send you? I'm noticing the Sagamore.
J.W. Dant.
All right. So that we'll talk about that. I'll tell you what it is now, but we're going to save that one last.
Okay. I'll put it aside.
So you were born in 1972.
Yeah.
That year, Watergate happened. The Munich Olympic terrorist attacks happened. So not a lot of great things happened the year you were born. But that bottle was bottled the year you were born. Yeah. So that bottle is from 1972. It's been sealed your entire life. I always tell people that, you know, everything that you've accomplished up to this point, that liquid just been sitting inside that glass bottle waiting for you to crack it and open it. So at the end of the interview, I figured we can crack it. We can cheers to your awesome film and, you know, celebrate you a little bit. And then, you know, keep the bottle safe for special occasion.
I'm excited.
All right. So what else? I know I sent you,
I have this too. Little, sort of, Jekyll and Hyde concoction.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's, you're getting it early. Exciting. So, that's actually the Prideful Goat. You can crack that.
Okay. Oh, good. I'm excited.
I'll drink some Legend. And, yeah. So what we did, we have a Kentucky bourbon and we're about to launch a rye whiskey and it's coming to California for the first time. So that is, all these are super high proof cask strength. It should be about 120 proof.
It's, it almost tastes like a sherry or something or a cognac. It's so sweet. It's delicious.
It's absolutely delicious. Yeah. So we're going to have something close, I think, in total to about 60,000 bottles in 12 states, New York, California. So you're getting it before it's even been packaged yet. I thought it'd be a nice little treat.
I should connect you with a buddy of mine who opens these amazing bars out in all over the country, but he's got a couple in LA that there's one called The Varnish specifically, and Slipper Clutch, which he has all downtown, where he serves this kind of stuff. It's like,
really unique stuff.
Yeah. You just have a cocktail and you're like, I'm going to remember this for
a couple. You know what I mean? I did want to ask you about the origins of this story. Cause I know you said you know, 2011, you grew up with, I think, three sisters. Was this something that stemmed from that, or something you heard from someone else, or what? Where's the origins of this?
Sure, that's it was sort of a confluence of things. One being that, you know, my wife was producing this late night thing, and we had done some crazy plays like Bingo with the Indians, some readings of Neil LaBute stuff, some Sarah Kane stuff, like readings, productions, and it was like, okay, the mainstream play is gone. And our theater always did edgy stuff, but late night was like, let's really push it. And I'd written quite a few plays, but I was looking to say, let's just, you know, take the filter off and really go for something. And, you know, the themes were sitting with me for, you know, my whole life, in terms of growing up in an environment where you have like a, you know, sort of like a tough guy posturing life. But then having sisters, and also, you know, having them dress me up and put makeup on, and having such a feminine presence, and then having that other, you know, masculine, just those two worlds that where they hit was always interesting to me. And it was always like, you know, you're talking about getting laid with your buddies or talking about this and that, and then going home and seeing your sister, you know, run to a room crying because, you know, a dude did something, you know, bad.
Very dude-ish. Yeah.
Or dude-ish, or, and even darker. And, you know, interestingly enough, my father, who's Italian, is very, very protective and was always like, you know, if anybody messes with your sisters, you know, you have carte blanche to like do whatever you need to do.
Yeah. Break their kneecaps. And whatever. I think that's the interesting dynamic of this, because you start the film out and the viewer kind of assesses the friendship of these three guys as three bros, right? Three friends that would, in every sense of the word, probably talk like that, right? Talk about the woman they banged, or the this or that. And it's a very relatable aspect of being a guy. You don't really think, you think of it as they would say, you think of it as locker room talk, right? You don't even realize the damage you could be causing. And then and which I love about this is that you see it from one side and you don't even really register it. You don't even pick up on it. And then you are forced to see it the other side. And it's like, Jesus Christ, like, you know, I should be taking, it's so easy nowadays, especially as a guy, to not realize how your talking could affect other people.
Well, I think that's a big struggle that a lot of people go through. And I think the movie is intentionally disarming and making you uncomfortable. But more importantly, to your point, is like feeling like one of the guys. And a lot of that language that is considered so coarse, it's just a comfort zone thing. It's like shorthand. It's like that, you know, you're just living in that space. It's like, but you're right. And then the movie and the story, obviously, then cutting deeper so that these characters see their own complicity. And then I try to go a step further and then subvert the audience as well and bring the audience to some places where it's like, you know, look, you could be offended, you could be provoked, but let's have a conversation about this. To me, like, really good art does that. And theater, great theater, certainly does that, to sort of go there. But, you know, look, the language, the way they talk initially, you could, you know, and I've seen it, where people are like, Jesus, like, you're not supposed to talk that way. But then halfway through, you're uncomfortable. You're like a guy, like, this is how it is. This is how it talks. And then subvert that further. And, you know, I definitely have always been interested in exploring these concepts. And then, and I think you could relate to that, having a daughter rewired me. And, you know, that cliche of like, oh, I was a misogynist and then I have a daughter. I mean, it was more complicated than that for me, but certainly having a daughter and saying, wow, I can walk into that quote unquote locker room and hear that way women are discussed or dealt with. And that's the thing is you can tell a guy not to say certain words, but that's not going to inherently change it. And that's sort of what the movie was an attempt to take a real deeper look at this and maybe have somebody, you know, rewire themselves or look at it a little differently, as opposed to just not say or act a certain way because they don't want to get into trouble. But yeah, having a daughter was really, I mean, you know, as you know, it's, you see that child, that baby, and you're like, wow, it just rewires you. And in a terrifying way, some way. So yeah, I mean, I just threw all that stuff in a box and shook it up and then said, let me write a play about it.
I think you bring up an important part of everything that's happening in the zeitgeist right now is we should be not just not doing something because we know we're going to get in trouble for it, but rewiring our thinking. I would liken it to, if I were to really dumb it down to something really simple, how many times in the corporate world I've sent an email or typed out an email and then erased it and reworded it in a more, what I knew was going to be a more productive way.
Right.
Right. So you can snap at somebody, you can get angry with somebody, even being married, you know, you have to learn how to talk to each other, not because, oh, she hates it when I do this, but no, I know that if I approach it this way, it's going to be a more fundamental outcome or a more productive outcome than just putting on a facade, right? So absolutely. I know so many people who are like, oh, cancel culture, I don't want to talk like this, but really they're still the same person. And when we're behind closed doors, I've heard just awful, awful things come out of their mouths. I'm like, that you're not learning anything. Like,
yeah, I mean, like, and to me, this is where I think art can step in. And I think that, you know, and that's why I think you have to have, you know, freedom of speech, freedom to go these things, because censoring something and changing it isn't necessarily altering the way people think. I've been transformed by plays and by movies and in some case music that have shifted my point of view and caused me to have empathy and insight into something I wouldn't ordinarily have insight. I think one of the most recent examples, one of my favorite movies of the last 5 or 10 years was Moonlight by Barry Jenkins. And I mean, I've seen that movie multiple times and that is so far out of my own life experience, but in the specificity, it created this universal story that just hooked me. And I was like, that's what art is. And you would never look at like the main character in that movie. If he was in the background of another movie, you'd be like, oh, central casting. But then to take a deep dive on him in a nuanced way, it's impossible to look at another human being without trying to imagine what it's like living in their shoes and doing that. And that's, you know, that's nuance and that's compassion and empathy. And not, look, some people are irredeemable. I do think that there are monsters out there, but I think speaking truth to life is the only way to do it. And I think we have a lot more in common than we don't. And policing the way people talk and think is impossible and not going to lead anywhere. So again, I always lean to art. I always look to that to think and to look, the more conflict and the more difficult and gray area situation is, to me, the better story it's going to be. So I'm always inevitably attracted to that. But yeah, that was the intent of this movie, is to just make something morally complicated. Like, there's nothing I want more than people to walk out of the movie, maybe argue about it, maybe talk about it. Maybe someone like you, who's like, it spoke to you in a specific way. Maybe somebody else doesn't get it, then they rewatch it or talk about it. I mean, that's what I want.
Yeah. Your team sent me a screener. And when I got to the peak of the movie and my mind was blown, I needed to tell someone. So I think I emailed Lisa. I was like, oh my God, I just finished it. Wait, I didn't finish it. I still got 15 minutes left, but it's amazing. Like, I was so overwhelmed by it. And I think you're right, because we're so quick nowadays to cancel someone or to attack someone for something we saw. It could be a comedy bit or something they did 20 years ago. But we don't want to give it the context, or we don't want to see it from their perspective. We want to separate ourselves and crush that thing. But mm-hmm. It's the exact opposite with art in theater, right? So one of the greatest inventions is the anti-hero, right? These guys are fundamentally, you know, I don't think they said it at all throughout the whole movie, but I could totally see every one of these guys saying the F word.
Right.
Yeah. Especially being from, I don't know if it was Boston or it was in that area where there was like, oh, I could totally see it's the time period's right. you can make all these assumptions about these people, and yet you feel for them. I felt for your character. I felt, you know, that you were a good guy, but was struggling with every, you know, your friends, your environment, the whole nine yards. It's art does that. Art provides context of characters and who they are as people far more in depth than what you'd expect from today's current process of being mad at somebody, Twitter, a tweet, totally. Or whatever the case might be.
Well, social media certainly is not designed for that, nor is politics. And it's why I'm not really engaged in either of those. But, you know, and again, to talk about the play, it's battle tested. We did a late night play. You know, the first time we did it, we're like, oh, my God, are people going to get it? That's the thing. It's like, are they going to get it? Are they going to be offended because they want to be offended? Are they going to look into the depth of it? And, you know, pretty early on, we found this great audience. We would have like theater addicts, people who love theater and go to all these plays sitting next to, you know, Bernthal has friends on the who are fighters, pro fighters sitting there. Who've never been to a play and they're sitting next to each other.
The surprising comment of the episode.
I know, right? Exactly. Well, I mean, that's the type of guy John is. And then, you know, just all our friends. So like our working class friends who have never been to a play sitting next to, you know, designers and people who live theater and everyone having a great time because it's like you're having a communal experience and the way you react to that brings you together. And that was, you know, again, that's what attracted me to theater and even more so than film initially was theater was like the lights go down and I know that the material is going to make me uncomfortable. It's going to challenge me. It's going to move the needle. I'm hopefully going to leave the theater changed somewhat or at least having something provoking me or thought provoking. You know, it's to me, this play was designed very much with like, quite honestly, like a Dave Chappelle in mind or a Bill Burr or comedians that you see where you get that queasy feeling where you're like, oh shit, what are they going to say? That edge of it, you know what I mean? Sometimes it doesn't work. Sometimes it doesn't, but to really bring you there and have that trust in an audience that you can, you know, you push the envelope and it's never going to be perfect. I mean, you're inevitably going to create stuff that, that people don't, you know, they flinch at or whatever, but, you know,
but that's what's for, right? That's the idea. I mean, I agree with you. I mean, Bill Burr, I never quite understood why he's so controversial because if you listen to what he's saying, it's like when he did his SNL monologue, he's making fun of something and people, it's like he could be making fun of the irony of something misogynistic or sexist or racist. And he's trying to point out that this is absurd and instead it gets taken the other way. And it's, comedy doesn't quite get there, but I think theaters, I think film is a bit more consistent, a bit more taken with the full picture in mind, no pun intended.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I mean, you know, certainly there's been movies and plays that deal with the most uncomfortable and extreme situations. And, you know, a good story is a good story. And if you try to do something and someone doesn't like it, I mean, that's part of the nature of it. Yeah, I think good comedy, I think good art is just truthful. It's just honest. And sometimes that honesty is hard to come across. It's, you know, sometimes that truth is hard to hear. And, you know, like Bill Burr, again, of course he's trying to be funny, but he's also, the reason it is funny is because it echoes with some degree of truth. Now, obviously I'm not going to be into an artist or someone who has like a awful, toxic, you know, cruel worldview. But I want them to say the things that maybe we all can't say, but by hearing them, we get rid of them. You get it out. You know, it's interesting. A good friend of mine who's a Black writer, one of my best friends, is an incredible writer. And he said something to me early on that just stuck with me is he's like, look, this guy is an artist. It's not like if you put the N-word in something, he's like, oh, you can't. But he was like, look, he said that he's so sick of seeing independent movies that have nothing to do with race, but the characters just drop the N-word as a shorthand for being edgy to get street cred. Oh, and he's like, I just think it's bullshit.
There's no substance.
You know what I mean? And I was like, oh, that's a really good point. And I've always tried to think of that concept in my work and like not putting in there anything in there that's like an easy joke or easily offensive. There's certainly a lot of language and situations and small engine repair that out of context might seem extreme. But when the movie is exploring that theme, you have to put it in there. Meaning if you're going to go there, make sure you do it intelligently. You know, the concept of you can be savage if you're smart. If you're doing it with a real intent, then, you know, that's what art is. But
there's got to be substance to it.
Yeah, substance. It's not the lazy, you know, inconsiderate, you know.
Low-hanging fruit.
Like, remember the low-hanging fruit? Like, I think about some of the movies you see, like, from the 80s and 90s where, like, I mean, like, rewatch Revenge of the Nerds, and you're like, oh, my God. I mean, I saw that as a kid, and some of the stuff was like, I was like, oh, Jesus. You know, that stuff is a snapshot of that era, and thankfully we've evolved from some of that. But, you know, it's, you know, that those easy jokes where everyone piled on and punched down, it's like, fortunately, we've moved away from that.
Yeah, I think that's part of the, you know, things that were scary in the 80s, like Jaws was terrifying. It haunted my mother. You know, arachnophobia, I couldn't sit on a toilet until I was like 16. Like, there was like this fear I had to hover every time I had to go to the bathroom. I go back and I watch those films, and I'm like, they're not scary at all.
Yeah.
But in that, so it's the same thing with comedy. There were things that were so considered so funny back then that are arguably hacky, or, you know, that they were legendary of the day. They were yeah, epic, you know, but you look back and you're like, they were really only, that was only funny because that's what made people laugh back then. Right.
Well, it's sort of like fast food comedy. Like you said, low hanging fruit. And you're just, you know, it's like Jersey Shore jokes. You know, if I did one, if I made a Jersey Shore joke, my daughter would be like, what? You know what I mean? That's funny for like 2 minutes. Although I would argue that I think Jaws is still terrifying. I think it's one of my favorite movies. I think that's still a masterclass of suspense.
Yeah. well, all right. So I did want to ask this. I know you can't say specifics. I have not seen the play. I've only seen the film. Love okay. The film. My question is there any, if you were, did you ever watch great film? I didn't think the American version was that bad. Old boy.
Yes.
Yeah. So in the Korean original, Old Boy, and the American revision, there were some major differences in those films and the plot twist and the key points in the films. Is mm-hmm. there a big, are there big fundamental differences between Small Engine Repair, the play, and the film?
No, I mean, the stories, the technology changed, like I said. The story is the same. The play was only the dude. It was the three guys and the Chad character, the college kid. And there were no women in the play. That's the biggest sort of change. The whole first act of the movie is a lot of it's referred to. That's all there. And, you know, there were some other, you know, something that was a monologue in the play became a scene in the movie and stuff like that. But nothing. Yeah, nothing really different in terms of the plots. A lot of the, to be honest, a lot of the sort of zinger comedy bits in the play that, you know, theater has a musicality to it, you know, the setups, the rimshot jokes, a lot of those didn't make it to the film. They just didn't feel truthful. It's funny in a different way. The movie's comedy is mostly thrown away, whereas the nature of comedy, a lot of times on stage, it has to have a stillness. It has to be delivered with clarity and diction, and you have to have a moment land. And in the movie, it's just thrown away. You know, some of the, you know, real big laugh lines, we just kind of made them real. And, you know, maybe you don't even hear them in the movie, but it's more, much more grounded.
Yeah. What else did you have in front of you before we, I know I've only got you a few more minutes. What other bottles?
I'll find on time, whatever you need. So then we got the only one we haven't officially tried is this.
All right, let's do it. So that's your birth year bottle.
Wow.
Go ahead and give us, what day does the movie premiere? And I'll pour something old as well. I think the oldest thing I've got with me is some 30-year-old Armagnac.
Oh my God, that's pretty good. to be 30 again. The movie comes out September 10th in theaters, hopefully in a theater near you. And then it starts its journey. And nowadays movies are released, you know, differently. So hopefully it'll be on demand. It'll make its way. So there's going to be numerous ways to see it, but September 10th is when it's sort of unleashed to the world.
September 10th. Well, I'm in no rush to let you go, but I do want to go ahead and give you a toast. I think this is an incredible accomplishment to go from, literally the story of this coming to where it's at is an incredible one. And it's a story that I'm telling you, I'm going to buy we'll go to Cinemark, near the closest Cinemark to us. We take the family all the time. I'm going to force my daughters to watch it. We're at this age now where I feel like I can't. I say things to my daughters, but I don't know that it ever gets through to them.
Yeah.
You know, I remember there was a point in time where we were trying to convince our kids, and this is probably going to make me look like a bad parent, but I'm going to say it anyways. There was a point in time we were trying to get our daughters to brush their teeth more, like when they were like 7. So we showed them pictures of rotten teeth, and to this day they remember, and their teeth look great. So we're like,
that's a great idea.
It's a great idea. So
you know, I can't get my daughter to watch it. She won't see it. Cause the actress who plays Dottie, who Frank hooks up with, that's my wife. That's her mom in real life. And she heard about that scene, which isn't gratuitous by any means, but she's like, nah, it's too weird. I don't want to watch it.
Yeah. Okay. I need to break that down real quick. I'll give you a toast. Cheers to you, buddy.
Cheers.
Congratulations.
Thank you, sir.
Your daughter's real life mother. Yeah. So there's no promise it's good, but that's 1970s dance to some of the best. It's some of the best whiskey out there. I've got a few bottles. I opened up one with Coleman Domingo, who's another theater actor that I'm in love with. Coleman and everything he does. We opened a bottle from his birth year. It was the same kind of bottle, J.W. Dant. It might have been a 72. I don't know when he was born. But they're one of my favorite gift bottles. I thought, dude, he deserves it. This is going to be great. But so your daughter's real-life mother's in the film.
Yes. And all my kids are in the film. My daughter plays the babysitter. My daughter's a very accomplished actress and in like a sort of musical theater prodigy. Her voice just makes you weep. It's incredible. She is, she's been in plays and in TVs and movies since she was 2, but she plays the babysitter. She just has like a little cameo. My wife plays Dottie, who's the Frank sort of date that in a better life would have gone well. And then the little boy who's sleeping is my son. So and Bernthal's kids in the movie, his sons were in it, but we had to cut their scene. They had a great little bit. And his daughter is the little girl in the very beginning.
Wow. So
we had all our kids. And Shay's daughter was in the movie too, and her scene got cut. But it was a family affair.
The daughter, your daughter in the film is incredible.
Sierra. Oh, she's breathtaking.
She's great. Her language caught me off guard a little bit. Like it always catches me off guard when you see a child speak to their parent in a certain way, especially with like a Boston accent. Like it was incredible. And then like, again, as the movie opens, I'm trying to make sense what the movie's about, mm-hmm. like, where are we going? And I realized, oh, we're building.
Yeah.
The whole thing was just absolutely,
well, you'll have to tell me what you think when you see it again with an audience, and especially knowing what happens, I think you'll have fun seeing how we really left the breadcrumbs out the whole movie. Like a lot of stuff is hidden in plain sight that you, when you watch it again, you'll be like, oh, that was just there, you know?
That scene, I don't want to give this away, but you actually strike somebody mm-hmm. at some point in the face. Mm-hmm. It looked and felt real. I know that typically, there's some situations in film where you see where there's a physical, they're like, actually hit me for real. All of these were fake hits, the whole film?
Well, so it's a little trivia there is our fight choreographer, Eric Linden, does all the Marvel fights. He knows John from Punisher. They're good buddies. And we gave him the script and he's like, yeah, I'll do it. I'm writing, you know, this would be awesome. And so he choreographed all those moments of violence. And, you know, you got someone like John who, you know, is a real fighter. You can't hurt that guy. And the fight in the bar was all like top-notch stuntmen. And
insane.
You could sell a hit. They're great. And then what's funny about Spencer at that point, when he showed up for his stuff, we had been working together so much, me and John and Shay, and it's like just living the characters and doing it. And the physicality is like, just bring it on. For example, there's a scene where my character's head hits the wall and we kept trying to do it. And I remember Bernthal pulled me aside. He's like, look, the only way it's going to look real is if I really throw your head up against the wall. And, you know, you got a crew and you're like, all right. And sure enough, he threw my head against the wall and it looked great. And that's the take in the movie. And it hurt like hell.
Yeah.
But with Spencer that day, we're physicality and he saw how we're working. And he's like, just hit me. And obviously I know how to pull it not to, but it's
sure.
I definitely, there's more contact in that particular moment than you ordinarily would have, but because we had such a level of trust and Eric showed him how to position his face and do it. And he was game for it, that you can't, you know, you could cheat it, but in that case, it's, I mean, it's not a full on slap, but it's more than probably a lot of actors are comfortable with, in Eric bringing him step by step and saying how to do it. So by then we were like,
yeah, I mean, if they're
be harder, I mean, he was gay.
Yeah. If they're willing to do it, do it. Yeah. All right. So next up, you've got, you're working currently on Hulk Hogan script with Thor.
Yeah. So I'm writing that with Scott Silver, who I mentioned before, for Todd Phillips. We've been working on that for quite a bit. It's going to be a beast. It's a really, I mean, it's funny, man. Like I love the story. I love the script. We're so happy with how it came out, but it's been amazing to me how excited people are to see a Hulk Hogan movie, which is really cool.
Yeah. So I think most people my age might have gone through some semblance of a WWE or WWF at the time. Like I remember my first luggage was Hulk Hogan luggage, and you know, and it was like a little blue suitcase with Hulk. To this day, I remember this from like 1992, and he was a big part of this icon of wrestling, and I've always been a fan of his. And then when he came back in like the 2005s. Are you guys planning on addressing, what window of time is this going to be addressing? Is it the full life of him, or is it going to be?
I'm going to be honest. I am like, there's so many eyes on this project. Like I'm terrified to say anything. And that's
okay. All right.
Yeah. It's the earlier days. I'll say that. And it's like, you know, the sort of birth of Hulk becoming Hulk.
Yeah.
So to speak. And you'll, you know, even what you've mentioned already, I know you would love the movie, and, you know, I just want it to be as good as it can, but like they, you know, they're so scrutinizing everything. I mean, I've never worked on a script that is so under lock and key. So yeah, I'm like,
okay. It's Chris Hemsworth, right? That's who's.
Yeah. It's Chris Hemsworth. Correct.
Yeah. Comedically, he's so funny. Like I know he plays mostly the bang 'em ups, but there's been a few things he was hilarious in Ghostbusters.
Oh my God. He's so funny.
He's so, I love it when you see someone, you see like Channing Tatum, another great example. He's in the romantic comedies. He's in the bang 'em ups, but when he makes a comedic appearance, it's so memorable. So I'm excited. Yeah. When is this supposed to come out? You know,
I don't know exactly.
I think this is,
to be honest, I think this is a movie that would be very difficult to shoot during COVID. And I don't know, you know, how that would work. So I don't know if that's part of it. I'm not sure yet. I think people are figuring out all the stuff as it goes, you know, but, I'm pretty confident you'll see it in sooner rather than later.
All right. One last cliche question.
Absolutely.
I'm going to hit you with it. Is there another core story, something similar, not necessarily similar in storytelling as Small Engine Repair, but is there something you've got deep down in your pocket, something that you've been wanting to work on that you have, now that things are rolling with this and you're moving on to the next thing and you're going to build up speed here? Is there something that, like, I talked to Coleman, he's always wanted to do the original Lone Gunman. What's his name?
Lee Harvey Oswald.
No. With the bandana, he was a white guy, but originally he was a black guy. The Lone Ranger.
The Lone Ranger.
He's always wanted to play that. The Lone Ranger is actually based off a real character, a black, ever sheriff. Coleman Domingo went into it. I was like, dude, you looked into the story. He's always wanted to play this character into a full length feature film. Is there something that you have that you want to work on eventually?
I mean, I feel like I have so many of those things, and there's one in particular that I'll talk to you on offline about. I'm really excited to share, but because it was never made public, I don't know if I can.
Okay.
So let me, which is really cool. And I love talking about it, but I'll preface it. So, I mean, I got a lot of stuff like that. I'm excited to write another play. It's been a while. I had a play, Rules of Seconds, which is one of my favorite things I've ever written, which was done in LA. It was done in Pittsburgh. I think it was done in Atlanta, and we're pushing to get it done in New York right before the COVID hit. And like, that's a sort of batshit crazy play that has a lot of the themes of Small Engine Repair. And then, you know, I got some really cool stuff in the works. It's about, you know, figuring out what it is. I think, you know, I'm in a time now where I'm working on so many cool things that you're just kind of going where it goes. But the experience of making Small Engine Repair, it was the first time in my life where my whole brain just clicked and I was like, oh, I'm completely like present This is exactly what I want to be doing. I don't know if I would act in another movie that I directed and wrote, but I definitely have a lot of stuff. I cannot wait to get behind the camera again and direct another movie. And yeah, I have some cool stuff in the works like that. It's well, just about time, man. It's about finding time and having this COVID shit go away.
Yeah. I think we're slowly working that way.
I do too.
It's slowly but surely. I don't think it'll ever be a complete shutdown as it was. But for your first ever, I mean, you wrote in it, you starred in it, you directed it. It had to be one hell of a job. And I'm looking forward to September 10th, my friend.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. Cheers. Cheers.
Balcony's first ever year-round bourbon was an inspiration. It all had to work together. A blend of carefully selected ingredients, Texas-sized pot stills, and creative people determined to find the absolute best way to usher a new whiskey along. When you discover how it pairs with a meaningful moment, suddenly the feeling of drinking great whiskey becomes a whole lot more.